Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning will be Smart Marketing Group, Incorporated against Publications International. Mr. Levinston.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. 9 months of operating its new business had put the plaintiff, Smart Marketing, almost $500,000 in the hole. In the words of one of its principals, William McGarrity, in September of 2003, this contract had been financially devastating for
But whose
SMG.
Fault was that? Was that because PIL wasn't producing the kind of leads that it had represented it was going to?
This is not a fault-based issue, Your Honor. I mean, the fact is that they agreed to a contract in which when dealers canceled, they refunded their commissions. And so, yes, there's no question but that we were having some difficulty getting our computing system online. There were also some issues about whether they were marketing recklessly, too fast, or in accordance with where our leads were coming from. But there's no denying the fact that we were not ready when we thought we might be. But that was an eventuality that everybody planned for. They started selling before we were ready to go.
As I understand it, number one, this case is only about the October 2003 contract, not any of the other contracts that were entered into earlier.
That's
because
correct.
They all folded into the October contract. And number two, that there were no promises made about any particular level of performance in the October contract.
That's also correct. That is very correct. The plaintiff persuaded the jury that that in less than 2 years they could turn this $500,000 deficit into $5.6 million of pure profit. This jury award rests on speculation, and it's fueled by improper evidence. And Illinois law requires that damages be proven with reasonable certainty, and that is a legal standard. Under Tri-G and Midland Hotel, that is the measure of damages. And the Illinois Supreme Court and other Illinois courts scrutinize evidence. There isn't the same kind of deference to a jury that there is with respect to most liability issues.
So SMG argues, though, that they met that reasonable certainty standard based on the evidence of how they were, say, ramping up to perform in this contract from the pre-contractual period, that this is not just somebody's imagination, that there was actual activity.
Their evidence rests entirely, Your Honor, on their own projections. And they showed no history of profits. They provided no market analysis. There was no indication of what the competition was. In fact, if you read this trial record, you might assume throughout their case that they were entering uncharted territory. There were no competitors, and that's not the case. But there was no market analysis. There was no expert that they provided on what they were facing in their efforts to enter.
Furthermore, everything you're saying here, you said to the jury in closing argument.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. And that's why I emphasize that this is a legal standard and that under this legal standard, this court has to scrutinize the record. And in case after case, both the Illinois Supreme Court, for instance, in the Midland Hotel, this case in this court in Emerald Investments, in Mid-America Tablewares, in the Mind Games case, although that was Arkansas law, it's a very similar standard, the juries had found damages. And in each one of those cases, the court said, no, we've looked at the record. And although, you know, in the Mid-America Tablewares case, they said the jury's verdict tracked the expert's testimony. But, you know, we think the expert was speculating, and so we're not going to sustain it. We're going to reverse it. And that's exactly what we're asking you to do here, is to give a real look to the underlying record. And you will find, particularly with respect to attrition, that there was no foundation for the attrition rates that they built into their projections, and indeed that the facts that followed those projections demonstrated that those projections were not correct. Those attrition rates were not correct.
So it seems to me, fundamentally, your notion, and you know, maybe this is correct, I intend to ask the same question to SMG, is that the real revenue that was supposed to come out of this arrangement was the ongoing month-to-month generation of leads for the various auto dealers, and there'd be a certain amount of money paid per lead, and there were projections about what those leads would be. It wasn't whatever number of people were signed up. People were signing up, but it's the ongoing revenue stream, if I'm understanding your position correctly.
Well, let me clarify so that you do. People were signing up. At the same time, people were bailing out. And the rate at which they bailed out had a significant impact on what the ultimate revenue stream would be. There are two ways that people bailed out of these programs. One is they quit. They canceled. They demanded refunds. They never paid. They just walked away from the deal. There is a second substantial way in which they left, they bailed out, and that was to say, okay, well, we'll take your leads, but we're not going to give you those nice monthly payments anymore, which have a sort of a premise of, on average, 16 leads. We're going to pay you a certain amount every time you send us a lead. And given the performance levels, and this is after the October 24 contract, we're looking at evidence that goes all the way up to the termination time in November. And after that, we were cut off from adducing additional evidence. People were bailing out in both respects. There were the approved program, which was the earlier program, the non-lead program, was proving unsatisfactory because once the leads program came on board, lots of people wanted leads instead or in addition. There was some, and our people were slow. It's true.
The parties agreed to temporarily suspend the approved program.
Well, they stopped selling it so that they could bring the leads and listings program online. But what happened in the ensuing months, if you look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 69, our employees said our program revenue is down considerably because of cancels and no pays, is people stopped going with that program. And it's important to note that Mr. Birnbaum, their accountant, calculated 12-month contracts for both for everybody. And he calculated renewals at 12-month contracts, although the program didn't last long enough for anybody to even renew once. So all of his renewals were 12 months. So those 12
But the monthly income Mr. Birnbaum was expecting was going to come in was from the sale of leads.
Yes.
Once you're signed up, that's where the money's going to come
from,
right?
Well, it's from a – there's an initial territory fee, and then there was monthly fees. And they were monthly. They were sort of based on a calculation, but they were not strictly based on per leads. And so people stopped paying those monthly rates and went to payment per lead. So almost – three-quarters of the people in the approved program either transferred, and when they transferred to leads and listings, for the most part, they either demanded refunds or credits, and furthermore, they switched into a pay-per-lead mode rather than a 12-month contract with a guaranteed monthly payment. And on the leads and listings side, by November, there's a spreadsheet that's Plaintiff's Exhibit 64, and of the 300 or so dealers, over 120 had switched from the 12-month monthly payments system to a pay-per-lead status. And so all of those calculations that went out for 2 or actually 3 years, and there's a question about that too, but all those calculations were demonstrably wrong based on the actual market evidence of what had happened there.
Now, is this the kind of argument that goes more to a 50B motion or to your alternative ground motion for new trial on damages for excessiveness? It seems that PIL breached this contract and that SMG suffered something.
Well, our evidence was that they actually still owed us money on the commission side, on the refund side, when the deal ended, when the termination occurred. There are cases that go both ways. Most of the Seventh Circuit cases, Mid-America is a new trial case. Most of the Seventh Circuit cases go the other way. In fact, most of them, frankly, are affirming summary judgment, saying that your evidence is not consistent with what the market conditions are, your expert's testimony doesn't make sense, what have you. So the Zenith case, the TAS distributing case, those affirm summary judgment, and they don't even get to see a jury. So we think that in the first instance, this should be a judgment as a matter of law. They had their opportunity. They did not bring in an expert. They did not demonstrate any history of profits. They did not show what competitors in the market who were doing Internet leads were doing, how they were doing, whether the market was expanding, contracting. They did none of that, and they should not get a second bite at the apple in this case. You know, their projections were based solely on what Mr. McGarrity and Mr. Welch thought about the market, and they didn't do any market study. In fact, Mr. McGarrity was adamant because I think he was trying to steer the rocky shoals between testifying as an expert versus testifying as a layperson. He was adamant that he didn't take anything else into account but his experience. And
did anybody ever try to regionalize this evidence of the leads that PIL was supplying, you know, the Chicago market, the Miami market, the San Francisco market?
The evidence, I don't recall seeing anything that accumulated evidence in terms of regions. I mean, there was discussion about the fact that their sales were not consistent with where our leads were coming from. There was some indication that they were trying to improve in that respect, to be quite frank, but there was nothing that broke it down in that respect. There was no testimony explaining that. So these projections are just the kind of projections that this court rejected in the Zenith case, for instance. In fact, entered summary judgment for the defendant. Reliable inferences depend on more than say-so, and that's true whether the person doing the saying is a corporate manager or a putative expert, and that's what this court held in that case. So I think it's a very important and very telling situation that all they have is their own say-so, based on very limited experience. There was, Mr. Welch, who is the CEO of the company, said, we've been doing Internet leads for 3 or 4 weeks now.
But what about that little excerpt of testimony where he thinks it's crazy that he doesn't know anything about it?
That's Mr. McGarrity, he's a salesman. He never backed that up. There was not a single instance of an example in the record where prior to this situation he was selling Internet leads programs. There was none. And indeed, if you look at their brief, although they set this out, when they then follow up with talking about his experience, they talk about his experience selling leads but not Internet leads.
Somebody must have been doing, though, because I thought there was some evidence in this record that PIL eventually decided to develop its own software, but there was some other software out there that they could have purchased.
That's part of, I think, what was wrong with their evidence. There were competitors in the market who were doing it. Delix was one, AutoNation was one. There were a number of people who were doing this, and had they entered the market ultimately, they would have been in competition with those people, and yet, again, there's no indication from the plaintiffs in the evidence about what impact that competition would have had on their success in penetrating the market. So, yes, there were people doing it, but these people had not done it before, and not in any quantity, and not for a specific Internet lead program like this one. And the person we hired also said in testifying, although they tried to make us part owners of their projections based on Mr. Whitmore, he testified that his first experience with Internet leads and an Internet lead program was February of 2003 with us. So there is no prior experience there.
Your Rule 59 argument is based upon some of these same arguments, but also on some claimed evidentiary rulings of the
yes.
district court that were in error. Perhaps you could
sure.
move to those.
Absolutely.
Before your time runs out.
They are, in many respects, they're interrelated. For instance, we talk about the insufficiency of the projections. The fact is we objected to their admission. We don't believe they should have been admitted at all. Under the TAS distributing case that this court ruled on, projections like that that are discussed between the parties but not admitted into the contract are should be excluded from evidence, and that's what TAS distributing said. With respect to their expert testimony, we've been talking about that. Really, they did testify as experts. When you talk about your experience, you're testifying as an expert. When you talk about what you know, which is what the business, what your business is doing, for instance, the Allied Systems, the Grover, the auditor there, here they weren't talking about their business. They were talking about what was happening out in the marketplace. That was his experience, as he said. So that was expert testimony. He never qualified as an expert. There was no advance lead. It should have been excluded as well. And finally, I'll just make brief reference to the exclusion of the actual revenues. The cases where lost profits have been found, generally like Malatesta and Rhodes, involve proof of what the person was doing with that program at that time after the people were out of the, after the plaintiffs were out of the picture, and that was excluded here, and that was error too, because the offer of proof demonstrated that the actual revenues from these programs were actually less than the jury wound up awarding. So I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Mr. Ziegelmuller.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I proceed? Your Honors, there's no dispute that the jury in this case was properly instructed. The jury heard all the evidence, considered all the evidence, and it is undisputed, properly found that PIL breached its agreement with SMG and acted in bad faith by terminating that agreement for cause when no cause existed.
So I have some questions for you, though, about the evidence supporting the damages portion of that, because, of course, this is a contract case, and damages for that breach, which I take it is not being challenged, could range from anything from nominal up to the amount that you had asked for. What evidence did you present first about the ratio in the market of wholesale leads to retail sales?
Your Honor, there was no direct evidence about any such ratios on that. I will say that the evidence at trial was that leads are a thing of value. Leads aren't a new product.
I don't disagree with that, but if the ratio is for every every 100 wholesale leads, one leads to a retail sale, that would be one thing. If it was for every 10 wholesale leads, one leads to a retail sale, that would be quite another thing. And it looks to me like the concrete evidence in this market really came from the wholesale market, and you're extrapolating. So I just wondered what lies underneath that extrapolation.
Well, the evidence showed that PIL and other people sell their leads to wholesalers. Wholesalers aren't the ultimate consumer of these. They, in turn, sell on a retail basis. And, for example, Info for Cars, which is the entity that Mr. Welch was selling consumer guide leads to dealers for, they, in turn, sold to dealers. So, ultimately, the dealers are the consumer on a retail basis of the leads that are in the wholesale market.
That. And so, I guess so your answer basically is there's no evidence about the ratio, because what PIL and you, your company, SMG, were hoping was that you could pull out that middleman, and SMG was going to sell PIL's leads directly to these car dealers, who are, in this instance, the customers. I understand that. But we don't know anything about how to correlate PIL's old experience on wholesale leads to the number of actual sales you could make to a dealer.
I think it's correct that we don't know the exact ratio of how many leads per se you would need in order to generate how many particular retail sales. There was some testimony about the number, for example, in February of 2003, PIL generated 10,000 leads, and it sold approximately 4,500 of those to Info for Cars' retail network, and about 5,900 of those on a wholesale basis to Delix. So those numbers give you some basis to extrapolate, but the fact of the matter is that every lead in the marketplace is a thing of value. Now,
no, it isn't, actually, which is why I asked the question about geographical scatter. Internet's, you know, is famously something that you can access anywhere at any time. In fact, you could be at your vacation home in Fiji, and you could be looking at car leads if you wanted to. And so, and yet, this is a market where what the dealers want is a potential customer. They want to be able to follow up with that customer. So aggregate information about nationwide leads doesn't tell us very much about how many dealers in the Chicago area are going to benefit by those leads, how many dealers in the Southern California are going to benefit. And I just wonder whether some of the dealer frustration with this program came about because the aggregate number of leads just doesn't tell us very much about how many leads would be useful to any particular dealer or any particular region.
Well, certainly the dealers depend on getting leads from their market area, and that's what was promised to them. Now, that was the responsibility of PIL, was to sort the leads to go to the correct dealers.
No, and I understand that, and I think we can all understand that PIL fell down in the job. I mean, you guys entered into a contract in October 2003, and PIL didn't deliver, at least on the timetable that had been indicated, what you thought you were going to get. But my problem with that is this contract doesn't seem to contain any strictly enforceable quantity or any strictly enforceable timetable. And so it's hard for me to say that that alone amounted to amounted to the kind of thing that you're saying. Well, you're in essence saying they really did have a minimum quantity and they failed to deliver it to us, and I don't see that in this contract.
Well, Your Honor, there are several responses to that. First and foremost is PIL is the entity that entered into each of these contracts with these 400 and some dealers that they promised leads to.
That's the problem in a way. I mean, apparently they didn't have the leads to deliver and the dealers were unhappy, but you're saying that if this contract had gone forward from October through the term of the contract, you would have earned a lot of money. And I guess I'm trying to separate out in my mind the amount of money you earned every time you signed up a dealer, call that the startup, and the income stream that you were expecting from that dealer. And even though you've pointed to your track record during the spring of 2003 on the sign-up income, I don't see where the evidence is of the income stream.
Well, Your Honor, the fact of the matter is that they did have enough leads to service the dealers at the rate that they were accepting contracts from SMG.
But how do we know that?
Well,
how do we know that in any meaningful sense?
Plaintiff Exhibit 40, Your Honor, is one of the two best indications that you have. That's the September 30th email where Mr. Whitmore, who ran the program for PIL, says there are ability to fulfill leads at a higher than forecast rate. This is after SMG had sold 152 contracts in September.
But they still hadn't sold anything, though, really. I mean, they didn't have their software up and running at that point. They might have been giving a dealer in Chicago a San Francisco lead. They might have had bad information, false contact information, out-of-date contact information.
Well,
they're talking about website hits, right, on this consumer, whatever they are, consumerguide.com.
No, Your Honor, they're not talking about consumer hits. They're talking about leads per se.
But the leads are derived from website hits, and a certain number of people go to the website, fill in a certain amount of contact information.
They are.
It's all derived from the website.
The website and other sources, yes. And SMG was conscious of that, and SMG sold a variety from anywhere from 8 to 32 leads per month to dealers based on the brands and the location about how many leads these dealers were likely to get.
And what information was SMG relying on when it decided whether it was going to have an 8-lead contract or a 32-lead contract?
That's the knowledge of the marketplace, the knowledge of where the leads are likely to come from.
What evidence did they... So do we know how somebody made that decision? Was it kind of seat of the pants, or was it Certainly couldn't have been track record.
Keep in mind, they're talking with PIL daily about this, and PIL has to accept these contracts. And never once did PIL ever say, we can't promise this dealer 10 leads, you need to promise this dealer 8 leads. PIL accepted these contracts, and they had every right to say, don't promise this dealer so many leads, we can't generate that many. So there was a constant dialogue about each of these contracts, and PIL accepted them. The basis for how many leads and how many per dealer and per brand is based on the salespeople's knowledge of the product, based on PIL's knowledge of their website, the number of leads they have. But never once did PIL ever tell SMG that there was a shortage of leads to be distributed to dealers. Never once did they say, you can't promise a Toyota dealer this many leads or a Hyundai dealer this many leads.
Doesn't the damages evidence have to take the next step and get into the question how many dollars were flowing in from these contracts?
It does, Your Honor.
PIL may not have had any idea what it was doing either. Maybe nobody in this case did.
Well, that I believe is a red herring, because PIL knew exactly how many leads it generated. PIL knew exactly how many leads
it was. They knew how many wholesale leads they were getting. They didn't know the retail market because they hadn't been in it before.
Well, they certainly knew how much their leads were worth on the retail market at the time they decided to launch this program, which is why they reached out and did it. And certainly they would not have launched this program
in the hands of somebody with decent software and experience,
which they could have bought on a moment's notice from Deelix or various other people in the market. The distribution issue is separate apart from the number of leads. I think.
But I'm trying to get down to dollars, actually, because I'm troubled that we don't know anything about the ratio. I'm troubled that we aren't taking into account the attrition rate. I'm troubled that we don't know anything about the geographical scatter, and I'm troubled that the number of leads that people optimistically think they can get from these websites might not relate to the actual number of leads.
Well, Mr. Whitmore himself, in an email to his own CFO on October 28th, which is shortly before SMG was terminated, indicated that there was no endemic problem with the generation of leads, and that the distribution problems were a short-term issue which would be remedied by December 2nd.
But, of course, we have no evidence in the record about what happened after December 2nd.
Well, Mr. Whitmore did say that by mid-December, I think his trial testimony was, is that they did have that problem solved and they were able to distribute leads. We don't know any,
because the district court decided to exclude the evidence of what happened after the termination.
Well, PIL never offered any evidence about what happened to the existing dealers or its ability to deliver leads after the termination. The only evidence the district court excluded was a number that was taken out of context about how much revenue the Consumer Guide programs generated for PIL over this course of time. There was never any meat to that bone.
What this is all about, though? You didn't want to be in a money losing. I mean, why should we pay you damages for losing money?
Well, we were losing money on a cash flow basis because we weren't getting paid by them, which is the evidence that Your Honor referred to in Mr. Levenstam's presentation. The programs were not money losing. We got a percentage of the money that the dealers paid for these leads, and our expense structure is not at issue on appeal. So,
what about the dealers who left the program?
Your Honor, there is not a shred of evidence in the record that any lead and listings dealer quit the program. They're trying to presume attrition based on the assumption that there weren't enough leads. If there are enough leads, there's no reason for any dealer ever to leave the program. As for the approved program, there is some evidence that a few approved dealers had left the program. But even the exhibit they cite shows that 15% of the approved dealers had canceled. Their own evidence admits that the only reason that those approved dealers quit was because they didn't get what they were entitled to by PIL. Now, that's not an indictment of the whole program, and the evidence showed that by October, PIL was finally giving them what they were supposed to get under the approved program. So that may have been attrition in that case, but SMG's models assumed 24% annual attrition in the approved program and 12% annual attrition in the leads and listings program, which is still far in excess of the 15% cancellation that they cite when they weren't even performing in the approved program. So those are significant attrition rates that are, in fact, factored into SMG's damages model.
Can I ask you to go back to the trial? Tell me what the primary focus was, if there was one. Was it whether, in fact, there was a breach of contract, or the damage question?
It was very much the former, Your Honor. I mean, they took the position that they had cause. They sent us a letter that identified three bases for cause under the contract. We went through a whole lot of battle at trial showing that none of those three causes was, in fact, based in fact, and none of them held any water, and that, in fact, PIL acted in bad faith by terminating the contract when no cause existed.
That was the primary focus of the trial. I mean, damages, obviously, were important, and lost profits is always sort of out there a little bit. It's not a concrete thing. And these leads are sort of difficult. If you've ever seen Glengarry Glen Ross, you know there are a lot of bad leads that the salesman has to work. What did you ask the jury to return as a fair damage figure here for lost profits?
I believe the final number on the spreadsheet was approximately $8.7 million.
What did, I understand the defense was primarily that there was no breach of contract. They had just cause to terminate you. Was there a suggested damage figure by the defendant in the event the jury were to find the breach?
Well, actually, Your Honor, both parties' experts, used essentially the same model and the same basis for calculating their numbers. If you change the assumptions, as their expert did based on the testimony of Dylan McDonald and on his own conversations with PIL's principals during litigation, you come up with different numbers. So instead of
come up with, didn't they say $400,000?
He said at most, I think the number was $363,000 would be the most that would be owed given this set of assumptions.
Offer a number.
Is that what they said to the jury?
I believe so, and I think they also offered a range of, you know, theoretically they owed us some money if you believe that all these cancellations were, you know, things that should be refunded, but no more than $363,000 is the number that I believe.
Your expert wasn't a market analyst or an expert in this area of internet marketing. He was just an accountant, a numbers cruncher.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So he was not permitted to testify about any of the assumptions that he was basing his calculations on.
Correct, Your Honor. He like Mr. Katz, who was their accounting expert, had no market expertise. He based his projections as he testified on the contemporaneous documents that the parties exchanged and used and relied upon in the course of their business.
The projections.
And also he looked and he analyzed the actual performance of all 550 contracts that SMG sold for PIL. He took the material terms out of them and used the average monthly value of those contracts.
And that
basis
covered
for
what span of time?
That covered from when we began selling the approved program in March until the date of our termination. In fact, even after our termination, they accepted some contracts that we had put into the works.
So what period of time is that?
Through November 18th. Your Honors, the notion that this was financially devastating to SMG is simply not the case. The one exhibit that they refer to when they say that it is Mr. McGarity's complaint that we're not getting paid on time by PIL. And the contract that was in place at that point in time, which was in September, required PIL to advance 50% of the total commissions we'd earn over the life of a dealer contract to SMG. Keep in mind, SMG's costs of making a sale are all up front. And the income stream, as Your Honor has pointed out, comes over the course of the dealer contract. So the dispute was whether we were getting paid the 50% advance that we were entitled to by the July agreement.
No, it wasn't, but, well, yes and no. I thought we were only looking at the October agreement.
To be sure, for breach purposes of the trial, we are, Your Honor. The exhibit that
so
they're
why
referencing.
Are you entitled to damages under the July agreement?
We're not, Your Honor. We never claimed damages under the July agreement. What we were entitled to at the time Mr. McGarity wrote the email where he says that this is financially devastating was saying, we're not getting paid. You're not paying us for our upfront efforts. We have to pay our salespeople. We have to pay commissions, and we're having a cash flow problem. But he was not, in no way saying that the program itself was a money-losing proposition. Your Honors, I want to touch on the evidentiary issues very briefly that were raised with no further questions on the sufficiency issue. The projections that we relied on at trial were simply matters of fact that were created in the ordinary course of business by people based on their experience and their knowledge at the time.
But they really had no experience in this field.
Well, that's a matter of fact for the jury to decide.
Well, that's a threshold gatekeeping function for the trial judge in ruling on the motion in limine about how much of their testimony to permit,
They certainly had much experience selling leads to dealers on a retail basis.
But Welch and McGarity didn't have any experience with attrition rates.
Well, of course they did, Your Honor. They've sold many of these kinds of...
Not with this Internet business.
They've had plenty of experience with attrition rates in lead programs. And, in fact, with...
The Internet business is quite different.
It's not, Your Honor. The Internet is a means of delivering a lead, whether it's a postcard...
I understand that. The Internet is also a way of reading the newspaper, but it's different. There are significant differences.
Mr. Welch was selling, on a retail basis, consumer guide leads to dealers on behalf of Info for Cars at the time they sought him out for his expertise in this.
The point, I guess, of the Internet is how reliable is the information the consumers put in when they're willing to reveal something about themselves? You know, they put in their Facebook page contact. I mean, you know, what are they doing? And I don't see that Welch and McGarity had any personal experience on the attrition rates.
The problem of scrubbing leads is true whether the lead's generated by a phone call, a postcard, or somebody filling it out at a Costco.
How you do it is quite different, and the accuracy rate may vary by whether somebody's walked into your office and said, I'm interested in looking at a car, versus sent a postcard back, versus sent you an email, versus visited a website.
And how they did it was solely the province of PIL and their scrubbing technology to do that.
But in other words, Welch and McGarity didn't know anything about it.
Well, they didn't know the technology of how to do that, Your Honor.
And how to predict.
But they could certainly look at the program as a whole and say, this is a retail leads program from one of the most valuable publishers in the industry. These are valuable leads that we're going to get. So they could tell that the product that they were hired by PIL to sell would be an economically valuable product, would be popular in the marketplace, and that the dealers would value these leads highly.
Well, the question is not whether it had some value. The question is how much and how do you measure that. And the problem is that your principals had no experience in this Internet form of marketing auto leads, and so the projections weren't
worth much,
and it's your burden of proof.
They had much experience with all types of lead products
not
and selling these
lead
to dealers.
Product.
With exactly this lead product. They had experience selling consumer guide leads to dealers on a retail basis. The source of that lead is not it doesn't impact the appealability of the product to dealers, which is what impacts the attrition rates. They were given lead contracts to sell to dealers, and it was their experience whether these dealers would like this product or whether they would not like this product. PIL had the responsibility to actually give the dealers what PIL promised the dealers they would get in their lead contracts, which was leads. And they could have bought that technology from Delix, and there would have been none of these problems. They could have developed it on time. There would be none of these problems.
All right.
It doesn't impact the...
Thank you, Mr. Zin.
Thank you.
Mr. Welch's,
just so we're clear, Mr. Welch's experience with Info for Cars was primarily selling telephone leads because Info for Cars was primarily a call center. And if you look at pages 370 and 371 at the trial transcript, you will see that he specifically admitted to having had no experience with Internet lead programs before the Consumer Guides one.
So maybe you should answer the question he just posed. Why are they really all that different?
Because, as you indicate, Your Honor, it's a different product. It has a different – if somebody picks up a phone versus fiddling around on the Internet to make a call, I mean, those are – somebody calls to make information. It's different from somebody being on the Internet. It's a whole different product. The people who may be looking to buy the product – are the same auto dealers, but the product that they're selling, and particularly things like the validity of those leads, how they're scrubbed, what they're worth, those sorts of things, and as a consequence, the attrition rate on the other end are going to be different based on the source of the lead. Now, I do want to also add that I do not believe, having read this entire transcript, Your Honor, that it is fair to say that the trial was primarily about liability. Yes, there was a fight about liability, and we put a big fight about liability. But when you look at the issues that come down, the issues about attrition were huge, and there was a big fight about the damages. Don't don't undersell that. There was a big fight about whether Whitmore could testify about attrition rates, given his experience, and he confessed that he had no experience at the time, and that was excluded. There was a big fight about Welch and McGarity's experience and whether they knew about attrition rates. That was excluded. Mr. McDonald, our expert, the only expert on Internet leads programs, he was there talking about damages, about attrition rates. Mr. Katz and Mr. Birnbaum spent a lot of time up there talking about damages models. So it is not at all fair to say, and indeed, what responsible attorney would go to a trial on liability and then forget about proving up damages? They had their shot, they took their best shot, and it was not sufficient under the law. I want to point out that we're requesting in the first instance, I see my light is up, that we're requesting in the first instance that judgment be entered as a matter of law, reversing the district court's denial of our motion. And in the alternative, at a minimum, there should be a new trial on damages. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We will take the case under